Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
For business.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A month from tomorrow, the voting begins for Democrats choosing a challenger to George Bush. January 19th is the Iowa caucus. Over the last few months, we've been letting you hear directly from the candidates, taking our microphone to conversations with Wesley Clark, Al Sharpton, Joe Lieberman, Dennis Kucinich, and Howard Dean. Our goal is to dig in deep for a look at who the contenders are as people, politicians, and potential presidents. Tonight, we turn to Missouri Congressman Richard Gephardt. Dick Gephardt is running neck and neck with Howard Dean in Iowa and well behind elsewhere, but he is carrying the flag as the friend of labor and voice of the industrial Midwest. He's short on money and maybe on charisma too, but he's out there fighting tonight on Point, Dick Gephardt. Earlier, I caught up with candidate Gephardt on the campaign trail in Florida. Dick Gephardt, you've got two fights right now on your hands, it looks like. One with Howard Dean, one with George Bush. How do you see each of those?
Well, I believe I can win both. I really believe I can win the nomination. I think I'm doing great in the early states. I think I'll get a good result in Iowa and New Hampshire and the states that come quickly thereafter. And I think I have the best chance to beat George Bush. If you're going to beat Bush, you got to beat him in the Midwest. That's where I'm from. That's where I'm strong. And I really believe I can connect with voters in states like Missouri and Michigan and West Virginia and Ohio, where you have to beat George Bush.
But in Iowa, where you're going to face Howard Dean first on January 19th, we've seen polls where you guys are running very close. How does it happen that a kind of upstart governor from Vermont in New England can be doing so well in your neighbor state of Iowa?
Well, Howard's a good candidate. He's running a good campaign, but you have to get the votes. You have to get your people out. You have to win. And I do believe that I'm going to win in Iowa on January 19th. Howard has gotten a lot of the anti-war vote, which is strong in a state like Iowa. But I think there are a lot of other voters that are starting to look at who can really beat George Bush, who has the best chance to defeat George Bush. And I think when they do that analysis, they come out more on my side, and I think I'm going to win there.
Dick Gephardt, when you make your big case to audiences, what do you tell them? Why Dick Gephardt for president this time around?
Well, first, I think I have the most experience of any of the candidates in both foreign and domestic policy. And I think that's important. And in the perilous times in which we live, people are going to want a candidate with experience. And I think I have that. But I've translated that experience into bold ideas. I have a plan that would get everybody covered with health insurance and help everybody keep their health insurance. I have a plan I call Apollo 21, which would get us to be independent of Middle Eastern oil in 10 years. I've got a plan for an international minimum wage. I'd go to the World Trade Organization and ask for an international minimum wage, different in different countries, but begin to get standards up in other countries. And finally, I have a teacher corps idea. I'd say to young students, if you'll train to be a teacher, teach where we need you for 5 years. I'd have the federal government pay your college loan. So it's experience, bold ideas, but realistic ideas, and finally, the best chance to beat George Bush.
Let's dive into those. And first, on health insurance, you talk about universal health insurance. As I understand it, you would take the more or less $200 billion in Bush tax cuts, take those tax cuts back, and put that money to health insurance. Exactly how would it work, Dick Gephardt?
Well, I do have to lay aside the Bush tax cuts because this is a big program, but it's a program that most importantly helps everybody, and it would be better for average families than the Bush tax cuts. The Bush tax cuts only give you about $500 a year. My plan would give you $3,000 a year. So I'm quite ready to argue this with George Bush, and most importantly, I would get more Americans covered and keep them covered than any other plan.
And you're saying $3,000 a year in health care coverage, essentially? Is that what you're arguing?
It's in all kinds of economic benefits. Basically, I give every employer 60% of your health care costs, of whatever you choose. They have to pass it along to the employee. So we believe from studies we've done that this would put $3,000 of economic benefits in the average family's hands, as opposed to the $500 from the Bush tax cut.
So the government would begin to chip in to whatever your employer is paying for your health coverage. Is that right?
Yeah, it would set up a partnership. The federal government would pick up 60%. That would leave employers and employees to figure out the 40%. And if your employer goes above 60%, I'd get in 60% of what they put on top. So it's a really strong incentive to get everybody covered and to keep them covered.
And what about people who don't have an employer or whose employer has never offered them health insurance?
They would have to take the money and pass it along to the employee. And again, I'm giving them a real incentive to go above 60%. So this would be a chance for a lot of businesses that haven't been able to afford to do this to get to do it. I have business people come up to me all the time and say, I love your plan because it would allow me to get all my people covered.
And what about people who do not have an employer, who don't have a job?
We give you 65% of COBRA, which is for the unemployed. Also, if you're a low-wage worker, I would get you 100% of the cost of your health care, rather than just 60%. And I cut a check from the federal government to every state and local government, every school board, and every not-for-profit organization for 60% of their health care costs. This is national health insurance through the present system. I can get business for this. I can get labor for it. I get the health care people for it. We can get it done.
So you see, being able to line people up for it. On the other hand, you're taking the $200 billion that George Bush has put out there in tax cuts. You're taking those back. You're putting it into health coverage. It then does it not leave the same deficit? Does this mean, Gephardt, that you're giving up on a balanced budget? The Bush budget isn't balanced, and it sounds like this one would not either. You're just moving where the money's going.
Not at all, because I led the fight in the Clinton years to get the budget into balance, in fact, into surplus. And what we did was not just raise taxes and cut spending, some of which we did, but we also put in place programs and ideas that got the economy to work better, to create jobs. My health care plan would create 750,000 new jobs in the country in health care. That's the kind of activity that we need to get the budget straightened out. You can't straighten out budgets by just cutting and raising taxes. You have to do things that make the economy work faster. My energy plan would get 2 million new jobs in the country, which would mean more money coming into the government, less money going out. So it creates a virtuous cycle that gets you back to surplus.
Let's talk about jobs. You're sometimes portrayed, Dick Gephardt, as kind of the last hurrah candidate of manufacturing America. We know how many manufacturing jobs have been hemorrhaging overseas in recent years. How is America really going to keep hold on to those jobs or get some of them back? Is it really possible, or are we finished with manufacturing in this country?
I think manufacturing matters. I don't think we can have a good economy without manufacturing. And we are losing not only manufacturing jobs now, we're losing software engineering jobs. We're losing service jobs. This is a wholesale erosion of jobs in America to other countries. And to solve it, we need a lot of things. First, we need a trade policy that gets standards up in these other countries so that we're not on such an unlevel playing field. We need to give health care help for our companies so they're not this great disparity where they're competing with companies in countries where they have national health insurance. And we need tax incentives for companies to keep manufacturing in the United States. If we stay on the unlevel playing field we're on, we're never going to keep any jobs in this country. You can't fulfill environmental requirements, health care requirements, and wage disparities and compete with countries and companies in the world.
But, of course, a global economy is never exactly a level playing field in all terms. Some places have cheaper resources. Some have cheaper labor. There's all kinds of variables. What are you suggesting here, kind of protectionist walls for the United States or the global minimum wage you talk about? What does that mean?
I'd go to the World Trade Organization and ask for the imposition of an international minimum wage by every member. It would be different in different countries. But there's got to be a condition set on entrance into the world trading community. If we just let everybody come as they are and never change anything, we're never going to have compatibility, and we're never going to build any consumers in the world. We're well on our way to having all production and no consumption, all supply and no demand. So to really make this work for everybody, we've got to try to use the trading relationship to bring pressure on other countries to more quickly change their circumstances. Can't be done overnight. can't be unrealistic about what can be accomplished, but you've got to use the... Let me just give you an example. The free traders before NAFTA said, just open up more trade with Mexico and wages will naturally go up. Mm. Well, the truth is, manufacturing wages in Mexico today are 35% less than before NAFTA. So they're going in the wrong direction, not the right direction, because we didn't use NAFTA as a lever to try to get conditions to change in that country.
President Bush recently backpedaled on steel tariffs that he imposed. He cut the last year and some off of the time that those tariffs would be in effect. You criticized him for that move, but it was clear that there was a trade war coming if he didn't make that move, that Europe would have gone to the WTO and they were coming after the U.S. on those tariffs. You criticized him for that. Does that mean that trade war is inevitable in a Gebhardt presidency?
Not at all. I would have gone to the International Trade Commission and asked for an alternative way to solve our problem, because I think what we're experiencing is dumping, which we've always had sanctions against. I also feel that I would do other things, like the healthcare example, like manufacturing incentives to stay in the United States, which would also help those steel companies be able to compete. Our steel companies are the most productive in the world by far. There's no one that's even close to our level of efficiency and productivity. But even highly efficient steel companies cannot compete with countries that have national health insurance, with countries that don't have environmental regulations, and countries where wages are a tenth or a twentieth of what we want to pay in the United States. So those are the things you got to attack to try to get on that level playing field.
Is this Dick Gephardt message working in this year? You know, people talk about old Democrats, about new Democrats like Bill Clinton, about new Democrats, whatever exactly that means, like Howard Dean. Where do you fit in the spectrum of the many faces of the Democratic Party, Dick Gephardt? And is your face current?
I think it is. I guess the way I describe it is traditional Democratic values and new ideas. What I've tried to translate my values and my experience into are really good, new, bold ideas to solve these major problems. And again, I think my health care plan, my energy plan, my international minimum wage plan, my other trade ideas are all new ideas to try to realize traditional, strong Democratic values.
What about on the security front? You were a strong supporter of the president on Iraq. Saddam Hussein captured this last weekend. Where does it leave you thinking about the U.S. situation in Iraq right now, Dick Gephardt?
Well, I think the president has failed us in getting the help that we needed from the beginning. If I had been president, I would have stayed at the UN until I got their help. I would have stayed with NATO until I got their help. I'm very concerned that he, even 8 months after the war is over, has still not gotten the help that we need.
But does the U.S. have any choice but to stay in?
No, you have to stay. You can't leave. If you leave, you'll leave it in chaos. It'll be a terrorist training camp. So we can't do that. But we've got to get help. I've told him that for a year and a half. I told the president that for a year and a half. He seems to be incapable of getting the help. We're in a very perilous time. We need to lead the world. We need to be engaged with the whole world in fighting against terrorism. We need to be fighting not only the symptoms of the problem, but the root causes of the problem. And this president's not engaging and leading the whole world to do that.
Dick Gephardt, we've just got a minute left. I want to run through a couple of issues here and see where you stand. Abortion?
I'm for choice.
Gay marriage?
I'm for civil unions and conforming federal law to civil unions.
Conforming federal law to civil unions, but not outright marriage?
I'm not for gay marriage. I think it's a religious concept that states probably won't accept it, but they may accept civil union, and we need to conform federal law to that.
Amnesty for illegal aliens.
I'm for earned legalization. In fact, I have a bill that says if you've been here for 5 years, worked for 2 years, paid your taxes, complied with laws, you can earn legalized status.
And finally, Iowa, it's only a month away now. Is that the whole story for Dick Gephardt? Do you have to win in Iowa to go forward?
Well, I got to do well. I can't quite describe all the scenarios that might happen. It's pretty hard, but I got to do well. I got to be at or ahead of the pack, and I've got to come out of there with a good situation so I can translate it into a good situation in New Hampshire and beyond.
It sounds like you're feeling good about that today.
I am.
Dick Gephardt, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Dick Gephardt, in a fight to capture the Democratic nomination, spoke with me from Florida. You can join our conversation tonight. Where do you stand on the man from Missouri? We'll be right back with much more on Dick Gephardt. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, we continue our series profiling the Democratic Party primary candidates. We've been talking with, and we'll talk about, Missouri Congressman Dick Gephardt, an unapologetic friend of labor in his second run for the Democratic nomination. Question is, where do you stand on the man from Missouri? When you hear Dick Gephardt's name, do you cheer or yawn? And can you picture Dick Gephardt beating Howard Dean? Can you picture him beating George W. Bush? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I am joined now from Washington to help us sharpen our focus on Dick Gephardt by Bill Lambrecht, Washington reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, who has written extensively on Gephardt's long political career. Good evening and welcome, Bill Lambrecht.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for being with us. Also with us from Washington tonight is Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large of the American Prospect magazine and a longtime observer of Democratic Party politics. Hello, Harold Meyerson.
Hello to you.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests, especially to Harold.
Hello, Jack.
Hi.
Bill Lambrecht, take us in here. How is Gephardt doing?
Well, I think that a lot of commentators have given this nomination to Howard Dean already, but it seems to me that it's sort of like the sports writers who lay out the season before the game is played. My sense is that if it's a Howard Dean or anybody but Dean race at this juncture, that Gephardt might be positioned pretty well. I recall spending a lot of time with him in the last campaign when he ran in 87, 88. He was at 6% in the polls, and in early December, he ended up winning that. That said, I think he has a difficult challenge to win Iowa yet, to beat Dean convincingly. And just to conclude that thought, I was talking to some labor leaders this week in Iowa. They were alluding to Howard Dean's support by internet activists and college students, and one of them said, we'll see on a snowy night when the wind is howling in Ottumwa whether the computer enthusiasts come out from behind the computers and the college kids come out of the bars.
Come out to the caucus. I mean, it was neck and neck in the polls very recently. I'm just handed the latest polls here, and it looks like Dean, at least this is a poll done by stations in Des Moines, St. Louis, and Chicago together. Dean with 42%, they're projecting, compared to Gephardt's second-place finish at 23%, even in Iowa. I mean, it's only a poll. It's not the caucus, but it doesn't look great, Bill.
Well, I would certainly agree with that.
And Harold Meyerson, what is it in 2003 that Dick Gephardt stands for in this race, to your mind?
Well, Dick Gephardt stands for, I think, a lot of the best of what the Democratic Party has historically stood for, in particular a strong defense of middle-class, working-class people at a time when they're really not doing very well and when the administration policies seem directed to benefit other folks than they, on the one hand. On the other hand, Dick Gephardt also stands for support for the war in Iraq, and even in the polls that have been taken since the capture of Saddam Hussein, when you break, the Washington Post, for instance, asked the question of, was this war worth fighting, factoring in all the costs and benefits, and when you broke down and look at the Democratic side of that, it was about 2-1 no. It was like 34% yes, 60% no. Dick Gephardt not only supported the resolution that the president brought before Congress in October 2002, but he really kind of undercut negotiations being conducted by some senators, including Republican Richard Lugar, to get one that would have made the president more accountable. And so Dick Gephardt is in sync with a lot of what the party stands for, and he's not in sync with the I think a lot of what a clear majority of Democrats stand for.
Harold Morrison, let me ask you on this front. I mean, Dick Gephardt clearly brings just tons of decency to his job in the Congress, to his run for the White House. But he has for a long time now also famously brought a kind of blandness. Does he have the spitfire, especially in this kind of contentious year, to really stand up front and win, to really go, you know, chin to chin, nose to nose with Dean or Bush?
Boy, that's kind of the opposite of the rap against Dean, that he's too angry.
Yes, fair enough.
This is the Jack Spratt and his wife phenomenon in politics. I don't know emotionally what the best way is to connect with the American people. I think it has something to do with conveying an aura that the nation will be secure, or as secure it is as it is now, or hopefully more secure than it is now, if you are president. And I think Dick Gephardt puts out some security vibes there, but he really, and in some of his debate performances, his more recent debate performances, he's caffeined himself up. I would say he's been really pretty vehement in his attack on Bush. That said, he's not the most exciting guy in the world, and Dean certainly revs up a crowd this year better than with the exception of Al Sharpton, better than any of the Democratic contenders.
Jack Beatty, what do you see when you look at this man, this candidacy, this political perspective?
Well, when you look at him, you have to think of his strengths first, and those, I seem to me, are where and who. The where is Missouri and the Midwest. I think I've on this program before, I've said that Missouri has been with the winner in the 25 presidential elections of the 20th century. They were with the winner 24 times. There's a kind of demographic political dial there that if you get Missouri right, you get a lot of other things right. I don't know that Howard Dean is going to carry that state. I doubt it. And then when you look at the where in terms of the key state there, the one that Bush carried by 3% because Gore pretty much put up the white flag and pulled out of it, Ohio, if the Democrats can take that one state, hold on to what they have, then they win. Well, Ohio has lost 300,000 manufacturing jobs since 2000. That's not Bush's fault necessarily. I'd say it's more Bill Clinton's fault for the China trade deal. But nevertheless, Bush is going to get blamed for that. And so you'd say that looks good for Gephardt. And then there's who? You said he is a decent man. He's also a very clear-spoken man, as we just heard.
Yes,
he is. He's able to really lay things out in a clear, coherent, unrushed way. And there's what that conveys is a sort of solidity of his persona. This is a guy, what you see is what you get. He's authentic. The negative is, and the big one, and the one I'm sure that Karl Rove is underscoring on his charts, is that he does want to call back all those Bush tax cuts. So does Howard Dean. And both men are liable to Bush in a debate turning to them and saying, look it, you want to raise the taxes of a guy earning $40,000 a year? If it's a family of four, $2,800. And that will be the truth. That's a very potent weapon for George Bush. And then finally, the when. I mean, there is a feeling about Dick Gephardt, for all that he talks about bold new ideas and so on, that he's yesterday's man. And that, in effect, he represents a part of the Democratic constituency that is just not as vital in the electorate as it once was.
Bill Lambert, refresh our minds, our memories on that 1987-88 run and exactly what happened to Dick Gephardt that year.
Well, at the very end, the Dick Gephardt who had voted for the 1981 Reagan tax increase was the fire-spitting populist on the campaign trail. I recall him in a black satin UAW jacket waving around a Wall Street Journal and declaiming against corporate greed. In the parlance of the trade, he was a candidate who found his voice in the last weeks of the campaign. He also had a decidedly populist advertising campaign with his infamous Hyundai ads. It's the campaign slogan, "It's your fight too," which I might add, some of that was put together by Joe Trippi, who is now the
Howard Dean's
the
man.
Guru behind Howard Dean.
Was this the sledgehammer to the Hyundai? I don't remember.
Well, this was an ad, as best as I can remember. It pointed out that the an American-made car would cost $78,000 in Korea because of tariffs, mm-hmm. but a Hyundai cost $15,000 or $18,000 in the U.S. or less because we don't apply corresponding tariffs. Of course, with the message that these result in job losses.
So he found his voice around all these things, and this was, as you've pointed out, a kind of turn from a much more conservative Congressman Gephardt that Missouri had known, where he was criticizing Ronald Reagan for not doing enough to end abortion, to block school busing, to promote prayer in school. He was even tough on Social Security in those mid-80s, but suddenly here in 87, 88, it was a much more liberal voice.
Well, there's no question about that. You could look at Gephardt's career as something of a play in three acts. That early on, he was a social conservative from the what is known in St. Louis as the Scrubby Dutch neighborhoods.
He early
in his career, he supported a constitutional amendment to legalize prayer in schools, to challenge voluntary school prayer. He was a means tester in those early years when Democrats were stepping forward to challenge Great Society programs. He was in the vanguard.
But he turned all that around, and still he ended up behind Michael Dukakis. How exactly did that happen?
Well, Dukakis had a great financial advantage that year. We've had so many governors elected in recent years in this trend, it seems to me that, if I'm not mistaken, it's been 123 years now since this nation has elected someone from the U.S. House. There are a lot of
To the White House, that is. I guess it was Garfield, right,
It was James Garfield that's right. So there are some built-in barriers mm-hmm. here for a Gephardt. And Dukakis certainly was the man of destiny that year, when, just like many commentators feel that Howard Dean is right now.
Gephardt went off to lick his wounds and led the Democratic Party in the Congress for many years after that. And now he's out again looking for that Democratic nomination and the chance to take on George Bush. What do you think? Is he the right guy? You can join our conversation tonight, 1-800-423-8255. Susan is calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sure.
I guess what I'd like to say, I've been in Vermont for the last 15 years and have either voted for the Progressive Party candidate or reluctantly for Dean, since he was such a moderate Democrat, and I don't see myself as being a moderate. But I guess and given the way that people are elected president these days, I really don't think that we elect people based on what they believe. Whether or not, in this case, for instance, I really like Gephardt because of his stand on NAFTA, as opposed to Dean being for NAFTA and Gephardt against it. I really believe that we're electing people these days based on how well they actually do on television, you know, how they connect with people's entertainment needs. That's a very sad thing to say, but I think that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly it appears that Dean is really good as a TV personality. I think people like the fire that he comes forth with, not necessarily even caring what he stands for. So I guess my thought is, my question, I'd love to hear other people's comments, is I would love to see Gephardt join a Dean ticket as vice president. And I'm just wondering if anyone thinks he'll do that, and if he doesn't do well in Iowa and the other primaries, and how that might fly.
Got it, Susan. Thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, let me put that first to you, this persona issue and how it plays through the lens of the television, and I guess as well whether you could see Gephardt buckling in next to Dean. Would that make any sense?
Well, this Dean temperament, which has been remarked, is something that is clearly connecting with Democratic voters. It represents sort of the objective, the emotional correlate of their political, of what's happened to the party, what they think has happened to the party, the cave to Bush, the bad campaign Gore ran, and you know that anger is communicating. He doesn't even have to say much; just show that emotion, and that connects. So I think she's absolutely right there. Of course, he does have a whole program. As for vice president, it seems to me that General Clark is destined to be somebody's vice president if he doesn't win this nomination. Or he's destined to be on that ticket, I would think.
Harold Meyerson, what's your assessment on the ticket and also on the way Gephardt communicates?
Well, I agree with Jack that Clark would be choice number one, but I think Gephardt, there's a strong case that Gephardt should be choice number two because he may be strong where Howard Dean is weak. And there are only two swing regions in the country next year. There's the Midwest from, you know, Missouri to Ohio, the two states that Jack cited. Mm-hmm. And there's the Southwest. And I think Gephardt is strong in areas where I think Dean unaided might have a lot of trouble winning. On temperament, I don't know. I mean, McLuhan said the medium should be cool, but you know, for politicians, that's that rule needs to be bent a bit. I have to say, though, that I'm continually struck, oddly enough, by similarities between Dean and Gephardt. If I could just go there for
one second,
Dean Gephardt, pretty much as you've discussed with Bill, kind of remade himself going into the campaign of '88. And a guy who had been a founder of the Centrist Democratic Leadership Council emerged as representing really quite a different wing of the party than that. Dean, in response to our caller's sort of preamble, Dean was indeed a centrist in Vermont, and he has converted himself too, going into this year. And there are many issues, the war being the great exception. There are many issues on which the two of them really come down together now. Both want to get rid of the whole tax cut. Both are expressing all kinds of dubiousness about globalization as we've conducted it. So, I mean, oddly enough, there are some not stylistic, God knows, and not on the war, but otherwise some interesting similarities between the two.
And you wonder which way the river's running there. Bill Lambrecht, what about globalization? Has Dick Gephardt brought that issue to the table and sort of brought the other Democratic candidates around? They're all talking a kind of combative tone on trade these days.
His international minimum wage proposal, I think, is fairly well out there, and with the exception of Dennis Kucinich, I'm not aware of other candidates going that far. Nor am I aware that trade that foreign trade is a particularly potent issue in this campaign. Now, when it comes to jobs, I think in job protection, I think Gephardt has lapped the field on that, and he certainly has staked a lot on those positions, and I think we'll see in Iowa whether it pays off.
We'll see. Bill Lambrecht, Harold Meyerson, Jack Beattie, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with and about Missouri's Dick Gephardt, Mr. American Labor, in his second run for the White House. You can join the conversation. Are you looking for a two-fisted defender of American industry, the American worker? Is Gephardt too sensible to win, too boring, too nice, too bland, too 1988, or is he just right? Can you picture Dick Gephardt beating George Bush, beating Howard Dean? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with and about Missouri's Dick Gephardt tonight, the voice of the industrial Midwest in the race for the White House, in the race for the Democratic nomination. What does Dick Gephardt stand for to you? Can you picture him beating Howard Dean? Can you picture him beating George Bush? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Washington by Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large for the American Prospect, by Bill Lambrecht, Washington reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Dick Gephardt's hometown newspaper, and our own Jack Beattie. Right now, Harry is calling from Boston. Hi, Harry. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I would love to see Dick Gephardt beat George Bush in the upcoming election. I'm a union member working in Boston, and the real war that's going on in this country, and, you know, we do have a war that's understandably going on in the Middle East, but the outrageous attack by this administration on working people in this country, I'm afraid, you know, if it gets by the next election cycle, I'll tell you, you know, 6 years from now, this country is going to be in tough shape. And Dick Gephardt absolutely is the only guy in that field who knows those issues. We fight every day, you know, you hear complaints about, you know, the high wages, the high cost of doing business, especially in a unionized sector, and you get into the manufacturing, how you compare. But when you have such a disparity, is, you know, the low wages and no health care, and I think Dick Gephardt is the guy who hopefully can pull this off. And I think what one thing that I see out there is that the middle class has evolved from so much success, say, over the past, you know, 10, 12 years, that a lot of people that are middle class and are getting hurt don't see it. And I'm afraid one day a lot of people are going to wake up and it's going to be too late.
Hey, Harry, let me ask you then about Gephardt versus Dean. How do you size those two up? Will Howard Dean scratch the same itch for you?
I'll tell you, I've never, ever once considered Howard Dean as my candidate for president. I think he's created a phenomena, maybe by enticing some, you know, some, maybe the college, he comes from a very progressive state, and he's got some of these progressive ideas, but I think that the real core problems that are facing the people in this country are the working people. The working people of this country are the bread and butter of this country. And
that's where you see Dick Gephardt standing right in that corner. Harry, thank you very much for your call. Bill Lambrecht, how about it? It hasn't been an entirely easy ride for Dick Gephardt this year with the unions, though he's got traditionally very deep support there. He doesn't make a clean sweep of union support.
He didn't get Ask Me, and nor did he get the SEIU, Service Employees International Union, which is very big in New Hampshire, and that's one of the reasons that Dick Gephardt is lagging behind in New Hampshire. But I recall covering him this winter down at the AFL-CIO winter meeting in Florida, in which Dick Gephardt really spilled his guts in the room, telling labor leaders that now was their opportunity to send the message. He was the guy who could articulate these issues better than anyone in the field.
You quoted him there, Bill, saying, "I've been with you in the tough fights." Basically, you've got to be with me now, or what's the message it's going to send to other politicians?
And to Congress, right? That's precisely what he said. And there was a real fight in the labor union hierarchy, but he could not get this extraordinary two-thirds majority that he needed. So now it's a fight among individual unions, and I must say he's got quite a lot of UAW support, a lot going for him on the ground in Iowa.
Harold Meyerson, how do you analyze the way the union support has broken down here around Dick Gephardt and Howard Dean? Why hasn't Gephardt made a clean sweep with his long, long record of loyalty there?
Well, I think there are some in labor who absolutely acknowledge, everyone in labor acknowledges the loyalty, excuse me, and everyone is thankful to Dick Gephardt for what he's done. But, you know, there are a number of labor leaders who also said, but we can't see this guy winning. I mean, loyalty will take you so far, but not necessarily far enough to get the vote of two-thirds of the unions in the AFL-CIO, which is what's required for an AFL-CIO endorsement. Plus which, Gephardt's strength is centered in manufacturing and some other unions. Dean's strength is in public employee and service sector unions, which are less directly impacted by trade, and so there's a division there. Plus, which SEIU, which is kind of this the largest union in the AFL-CIO, and kind of very, very fascinating and an interesting union.
Service workers.
Yeah, but it's a mix of largely healthcare workers and then public employees and janitors. It's all over the map. And a lot of the, not just top leaders, but leaders down to the local level in SEIU really basically agreed with Dean's position on the war. And they were impressed by just the level, they and AFSCME, Jerry McEntee, the president of AFSCME, were impressed by the sheer level of energy and buzz that was there around the Dean campaign, which really isn't to be found on any other Democratic campaign. And this is one reason why I think Dean's people will absolutely come out for the caucuses in Iowa.
No matter what the snow, no matter what the blizzard.
No matter what, these are people who feel, a lot of them really feel, that this campaign has sort of given them a collective voice, that they've been frustrated, they've been outraged at Bush, and frustrated at the Democratic leadership, including Dick Gephardt, for not standing up to Bush enough.
Harold Meyerson, let me ask you, beyond the horse race here, play a game with us for a moment. Try and picture the broad outlines of a Gephardt presidency versus a Dean presidency. What would the major differences be?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I think, ironically, given Dean's record as governor of Vermont of securing health insurance for the vast majority of people in the state, that that would be actually more of a signature issue, perhaps a little for Gephardt, that Gephardt would be somewhat more committed, but only somewhat, to rebalancing some trade issues. I think both any Democratic president is going to be stuck in the trap of this humongous deficit that George W. Bush has created, and that will constrain any and all of them what they can do. It's an interesting. I mean, to get back to the question from the union member from Boston, they're actually on a lot of these issues talking the same talk right now. But Gephardt has also walked the walk in a way that Howard Dean did not as governor of Vermont.
And has done it for a long time. Terry's calling from St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Yes, I'd like to see Gephardt as president and Dean as vice president.
Oh, you want to flip the ticket here. Why, Terry? Yeah,
well, Gephardt has heart. He's for the working man. I mean, I'd like to take a day off and spend it with my family. And Republicans don't have that in their agenda. They want us to work. I mean, like my wife said, 33 million people take a day off of work. That's a lot of revenue lost it for the Republican Party. And the Republican Party, as far as I'm concerned, is the upper crust of our society. They don't want us to have any time with the family. They don't want us to make an extra dollar. And as you can see, I'm an owner-operator of a truck. Mm-hmm. And fuel prices and the cost of living is so high, I can't take any time off from my family. And I believe Gephardt has that in his heart, that the American people first, then the agendas we can work on as we go down the line. But we need sanity. We need peace. We need harmony amongst the American public. And I believe Gephardt is for that. Now, Dean, being the vice president, he has fire. He can give the vice presidency's office a new look. I'm tired of all the past presidents and their vice presidents not being up there with them. I believe that they're equal in office and in power and in stamina and in ideas.
And Dean would be all that. Terry, we've got the picture, and we hear the fervent wish in your voice and the desire to have a day off from driving that truck sometime. Jack, I hear you there.
Yeah, can I just speak to that hard question?
Yes.
I watched Dick Gephardt give several speeches on C-SPAN to groups in Iowa, and he comes back to things like this. He says his mother worked for 42 years in various jobs, but because of issues about pension and pensions investing and so on, when she retired, she had less than $50 a month in pensions. His dad was a milk truck driver. He tells a story about when his mom died, which was just this year, that he went to the nursing home and how important the nursing home was. And then he talked for some minutes about the people who worked at the nursing home. And he talked about the nurses, but he went beyond that and talked about the people who performed the offices of dignity for the people in nursing homes, the underpaid staff, the LPNs, the people who really deliver the care that no one of immeasurable value. And I looked at that and I said, this man does have heart. This man does see that the dignity of people who even do labor that to most of us would seem repulsive. He's saying it isn't at all. These people save lives.
But Terry, calling from St. Paul, Jack, says he sees the Republican Party as the upper crust party, but the numbers don't show that. And you look at the polls, there's lots of people doing hard jobs also voting Republican.
Oh, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, in the last election, we had Gore carrying Marin County by 25 vote percent or something. And there's a Kentucky. In California. And there's a Kentucky county where the median income is $25,000, and he lost it by 20 points. So, yeah, there are a lot of folks there who are struggling who are Republican.
Dan's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Dan. You're on the air. Hello, Dan. Are you there?
Hi. I just, you know, wanted to make a couple quick points.
Yeah.
First, I never would have thought about Gephardt, but I have relatives in the Midwest who have praised his integrity and populist message. And I don't think he's perfect in any way, but it made me think differently. I think Midwest strength, and especially in an electoral college context, is really important.
Mm-hmm. So you're open to the idea.
Yeah. Second, I remember Jack Beatty, 1988, if I'm not mistaken, did a commentary on BUR about the populist values of Gephardt that was kind of as moving as what he just said about Gephardt. And I think that, you know, there's a message there that's really important. And I also think...
Jack, memories run deep here. Say what you mean and mean what you say.
If I'm right. Yeah. I mean, but the other thing is I have two questions. And
yeah.
One is, how are we going to challenge the greatest fake populist ever without a genuine populist?
You're pinning that label on George W. Bush.
You got that right.
Well, Harold Meyerson, let me put that to you.
And then I got one other question.
Okay, hang on.
No, Dan. I think that's a great question. I think.
First of all, do you buy the characterization fake populist?
Well, to a certain degree. I mean, but Bush's populism is partly a mix of it's stylistics. I'm a regular guy. I'm the guy you'd rather spend an hour with having beers than with Al Gore, because you'd get a lecture thrown in with the beers. If it were Gore, the regular guy atmospherics, of course, totally are contravened a million times by Bush's economics, which in this regard, the caller from Minnesota was right. I mean, the economics of the Bush administration are directed at the upper crust, and so of course the paradox is, as Jack pointed out, is though that. There's a hell of a lot of working class support for George W., but it comes around a series of issues about the military, about sort of whether the guy is seen as sufficiently religious or not.
No.
One of them. And if it's a cultural, you know, is he one of us or one of them kind of election, totally, the Democrats are in big trouble. They have to break through to those folks, and certainly economic populism is one of the indispensable elements of doing that.
Dan, we're not going to get your last remark. Our time is too short here. But Bill Lambrecht, let me get a last thought from you. Do you see that buzz of victory somewhere in the Dean profile here, or is it going to end up Gephardt, you know, going down once more?
Well, I think this program is about Gephardt. I happen to think that Howard Dean would be is a more difficult challenge right now than George Bush for Dick Gephardt. I think he's a very good candidate. He's a proven candidate. Unlike Howard Dean, he's been through this cycle that you have to go through. He's run the gauntlet. He's done a lot of things. So I think that in that sense, to answer the last caller, that he would be a good candidate against George Bush, but he has quite a mountain to climb before he can claim that mantle.
Well, the mountain is right in front of us now, January 19th in Iowa. Bill Lambrecht, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Bill Lambrecht, Washington reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and Harold Meyerson in Washington, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large for the American Prospect. Jack, one down, more to go. Gephardt, we'll see. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.